Good morning, and if you have your Bibles, I actually don't want you to turn initially to Hebrews chapter 4, is where Morgan left off. I actually want you to turn, well, actually, I'll tell you in a second where to turn. But I want to set this up by saying this. I think we're in a time, and where we are in walking through the book of Hebrews, it's so fitting to where we are, I believe, in our world right now. As I thought about this passage and I thought about dynamics that go on and the spiritual dynamics that go on, I'm just wondering, in particular now, do you feel tempted in new ways or in different ways? Maybe in bigger ways, or maybe even in more subtle ways. I wonder, because I think many of us are tempted right now, and so many times when you say this word tempted, you think initially you think lust or, you know, no, but I'm wondering, are you tempted right now, because we're in the midst of this, to just be discouraged? So many people have talked to me about feeling this low level of depression. You know, it's not this, you know, they're not in this deep, deep, deep valley, but they just can't, they're feeling like they just can't come up out of this hole that they're in. Are you being tempted right now to be impatient or stingy or jealous or greedy? I mean, I know in different ways for me, you know, you feel like you don't want to practice any self-control, you know, in so many different ways. In fact, this past week for me, I had a little tickle in my throat. We were on vacation last week out at the beach and had a tickle in my throat, and it started getting a little worse. And by I think it was Wednesday, I was like, you know what? I'm going to play this safe. I'm just going to go get checked, right? So I go up to this, you know, Advent care place across the street from Chipotle, and they promise you a 15-minute test, right? And I really hadn't paid attention to what the test was. So they call my name, and you know, the guy pulls out a really long swab, and he goes, and here's a tissue. You're going to need this. I was like, what? And so I just opened my mouth really wide. I was like, and he's like, no, I'm going up your nose. I was like, okay, all right. And then he proceeds to take this swab and stick this thing up my right nostril, and it went out the back of my head, I realized. That thing turned into like a sword, like a little javelin. And it was all I could do to not pick this guy up and just chuck him out the window. I mean, it was just like, oh my goodness. I thought you would go up a little bit, but I mean, it was way up there. And then, you know, okay, I didn't say anything. I moved a little bit. And then I was like, yeah, you're right. I am tearing up here. So I used the tissue and I was, you know, wiping off my tears. And I said, well, you know, you got what you needed. You went far enough, right? And I said, okay. And he goes, no, we got to do the other one too. Wait, what? And so that swab goes to the back of my head, comes out the other side, and he pulls it back out. And then I just wanted my mom, you know. I just wanted to rub my head and say everything is going to be all right. I just wanted to weep. And, you know, when you have these moments, I'm tempted to lose, you know, not commit a felony, and then, you know, I'm tempted to completely turn in my man card. Jesus is going to help us this morning face temptation. I don't know what exactly you're dealing with, but he is going to help us. How do you overcome it? These second generation Jewish believers were being tempted to give in. And they were tempted not just to sin, but they were tempted to literally give up Christianity. Give up your faith. Come on, right? Look around. Jesus isn't anything. Rome's in power. Come on. And the world was telling them, just come on, give up. And so what I want us to do is I want you to turn in your Bibles to the end of Matthew 3. Because Hebrews talks about Jesus being tempted, but we're going to read real quick about his temptation. And remember, in Matthew chapter 3, we're just going to start with what happens right before he's tempted, because I want you to make this connection. So this is Matthew chapter 3. We're going to start at verse 16. As soon as Jesus was baptized, he went up out of the water. At that moment, heaven was opened, and he saw the Spirit of God descending like a dove and alighting on him. And a voice from heaven said, "This is my Son, whom I love. With him I am well pleased." Then, now think about this. Then, Jesus was led by the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. After fasting 40 days and 40 nights, he was hungry. The tempter came to him and said, "If you are the Son of God, tell these stones to become bread." Jesus answered, "It is written, 'Man shall not live on bread alone, but on every word that comes from the mouth of God.'" Then the devil took him to the holy city and had him stand on the highest point of the temple. "If you are the Son of God," he said, "throw yourself down, for it is written, 'He will command his angels concerning you, and they will lift you up in their hands so that you will not strike your foot against a stone.'" Jesus answered, "It is also written, 'Do not put the Lord your God to the test.'" Again, the devil took him to a very high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world and their splendor. "All this I will give you," he said, "if you will bow down and worship me." Jesus said to him, "Away from me, Satan, for it is written, 'Worship the Lord your God and serve him only.'" Then the devil left him, and angels came and attended him. What's the key word that you see here? What's the key word when you see Jesus' baptism and you see what? His temptation. It's the beginning of verse 1. It's then. There's your spiritual baptism, and then there's what? Then there's your spiritual battle. There's a voice from heaven, then there's a voice from hell. The voice from heaven only spoke once. The voice from hell, it keeps on going and going. There's comfort, and then there's what? Then there's conflict. Can you relate to this? There's joy, and there's strength, and then what do you have? You have weakness. Are you okay with that? First, there's what? There's water in the baptism, and then there's a desert. You see this when the words say it's kind of now this. Baptism, now this. The thing that came down on him, the one that came down on him in baptism, right? The Spirit, who's the author and the comforter of all life, and he's water. That same Spirit comes down on him and does what? Drives him to the desert. Maybe for you, this is what God is doing. He's saying, "Yes, of course I want you to feel comfort. But when there's baptism, there's what? There comes battle. There's comfort, power, and love, but then there's stress, and then there's conflict, and then there's temptation." Is that the kind of Christianity that you were sold? Because some people, they just want, right? They just want the comfort. Imagine you get to the place that you're so filled by the Spirit, the heavens open, and you are feeling as blessed and as intimate with God as you've ever felt. Can you imagine Jesus, humanly speaking, what he felt at that moment of his baptism? And the affirmation of his Father. And then what do you do when Jesus says, "You come and follow me. We're going to the desert," right? We're going to look at some things in your life. The Spirit leads you to the desert. Some of you, I know, are in this right now. And are you angry at him? Or do you want to fight? Because when conflict or troubles arise, you know, we always think, okay, what have I done? Why am I being pulled to the desert? Why is this happening to my family? Why did I get this sickness or this illness? Why did that person die? Why am I being pulled here? And so we think, you know, we think, you know, it's got to be this cause and effect, this causation kind of relationship. You ever hear or you ever see the Disney movie The Sound of Music? Remember General Von Trapp and Julie Andrews, Floraline Maria? And I remember watching it as a little kid, and it seems like they kind of like each other. And there's this one song that they're singing, and they come together in this, like, I don't think it was raining, but it was in this, like, gazebo. And they kept saying something along the lines of, like, nothing comes from nothing. Nothing ever could. But somewhere in my youth or childhood, I must have done something good, right? And then it's all gross, they're going to kiss now. They did. But you think to yourself, why is this happening to me? Well, I did something good. That's why. Why is God blessing me? Well, because I did something good. Why am I being pulled out into the desert? Obviously, we've done something horrible. And that's not to say that there aren't influences, but when we make these correlations, when we don't realize, I think for some of us, that all you do is you think, how can I be most comfortable and how can I be most secure? But the person who was utterly led by the Spirit was taken out to the desert. The more God pours his strength and his peace into your life, you know what? The more conflict, the more temptation, the more struggle there will be. And you know what? If your life is absolutely spiritually tranquil, if there is no conflict inside and if there's no conflict outside, you know what? When we read the scripture, it says, you're not being led by the Spirit. You're not attempting great things for God. You're not even attempting to be pleasing to God. Anybody who says, I'm going to please God, I'm going to give God my pleasure, I'm going to give him every bit of pleasure I possibly can, you know what we know? When you do that and you pursue them and you live in the world, you will experience struggle, you will experience temptation. That is the principle, because baptism and temptation are never separate. Baptism is tied to what? To the temptation. And you think about Jesus. The first temptation was, okay, you obviously, Jesus, to worship me, get your physical needs and desires met. And he says, no. You know what? For me to live is Christ and to die is gain. Physical needs, desires. Selling out his soul to Satan for that. And then he moves to power. Show me, Jesus, your power before me. Come before me and show me how strong you are. In fact, in that particular area, the second temptation, Satan recites scripture. I mean, I hope you know how strong and how smart Satan is. He knows your weaknesses. And so when you see men turn away, men and women turn away power for the Lord, and I've used them before, and I don't ever like to do this, but Tim Tebow, who's a Florida Gator, is a great example of him saying, you know what, I'm going to turn away women to be, you know, sexually pure. It's not worth it to me. The power is not worth it. I know I look like Adonis. He never said that, but he does look like Adonis. I'm going to turn it all away. It's worth it. It's worth it. I'm going to enter into the valley of the shadow of death, and there's going to be a struggle because we know there is, but then I'm going to say no. It's when Billy Graham decided, you know what? I am not going to get a photo op with Eisenhower anymore. Or with, it was Eisenhower, and then I think it was Nixon. Because he realized he was being used, but it gave him a ton of influence. And he says, you know what? I'm not going to be filmed or I'm going to be with a president. I'm not going to put myself in that situation as much as I have before. It's kind of attaching something to the gospel. He didn't want to do that. It's powerful when we see those examples. Not perfect men, but men who struggled and fought, and then pride. And so my question to you is, how do you deal with temptation? And what's your struggle right now? And what does God, what is he calling you to? Because we know this, is that when you are called into the struggle and you decide to enter it, and you decide to enter into the conflict, you know what you're going to need? And he knows this. You're going to depend on him all the more that day you take that step than you did the day before. And you know what he gets? He gets your attention. He gets your words. He gets your emotions. He gets your behaviors. He gets all of you because he wants to know you and he wants to be inside of you. So when you think of that connection, Jesus' baptism was tied, what? To his temptation? What does that mean? When you experience the joy of knowing, not about God, but knowing him, be ready, because it's coming. He is going to ask you and call you to something more. And it's going to reveal maybe some of your weaknesses. It's going to call you into conflict and say, you know what? I've got to deal with this anger, because my comfort spot is just being truthful. And I don't want to show love when I give truth. And I can tell people are scared of me. But I don't want to have to be soft with my strength. And some of you are really soft. And God is saying, I'm going to call you into this. And for the sake of your daughter, you know what you need to have as a mom or a dad? You need to have strength for the very first time. But you're going to be tempted to what? Just be soft. And he wants to grow us. He wants to, I believe he wants to grow our church. I believe he asks me, hey, Frank, who... If no one shows up, am I worth it for you to praise me? There's an audience of one. That's it. Am I enough when you are tempted to always focus on numbers or focus on big things? And so, taking up where Morgan left off last week, Jesus is our high priest. Hebrews 4, 14, 15, and 16. Therefore, since we have a great high priest who has ascended into heaven, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold firmly to the faith we profess. For we do not have a high priest who is unable to empathize with our weaknesses. But we have one who has been tempted in every way, just as we are, yet he did not sin. Let us then approach God's throne of grace with confidence, so that we may receive mercy and find grace to help us in our time of need. What is he calling us to do? What is he asking us to do after, you know, when Jesus, we know he's our great high priest. And what did the high priest do on the Day of Atonement? We know this, Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. He went in and he gave the sprinkling of the blood on the Bema seat. It showed that death had come for sin, and God said, you're allowed to do animals in the Old Testament. I'm not going to kill any person. And then you just give me that sprinkling. That's the receipt. So Jesus knows, so God knows that it was actually done. And what he's saying is, do you remember Aaron? You remember all those different priests? We have finally have the perfect high priest who ascended into heaven. He actually died, and he rose again, and he ascended, and he sat. We learned this a few chapters ago, at the right hand of God the Father. So let us what hold firmly to the faith that we profess. Are you doing that? Are you holding firmly to what God has done? Because when we do that, We need to understand that we have a high priest who what? When I think of somebody who's going to empathize with me, normally it's somebody that I think maybe has my weaknesses and really, really struggles with them and maybe doesn't have a whole lot of victory like I don't have a whole lot of victory, right? And so those people that really empathize well, I'm thinking, well, thank you for that, but you probably still have the same struggle. And I would maybe see that person as I'm thankful for their care, but you know, I wonder if they, you know, they probably don't have the victory. And then there's those that I come into contact with that have victory over a sin that I don't have victory. And I know a lot of times those types of people don't empathize well. They just say, you need to change your life. Look what I can do. I control my tongue, you don't. Just start controlling your tongue. You're a bad person, right? And you feel terrible. You know, you kind of look up to them in the sense that they don't struggle with what you struggle. They've had victory over it. But what do you not feel? You don't feel the empathy. And that's why Jesus is so different. How can someone who has had victory come into our presence? We are the losers. And at the same time, he knows and he affirms the struggle that you have with money, with alcohol. He knows how hard it is to say no if you struggle with that. How hard it is to say, okay, no, I'm not gonna say that. And he knows in those moments, even when you have victory or when you have defeat, he empathizes with you and he's already defeated that struggle. You tell me someone who does that well. I've never met that person. That's what's unbelievable about who Jesus is. We have a high priest who empathizes with every one of your weaknesses. He does not shame you. And the problem is that you probably shame yourself. When you mess up, you probably go home, put your head on the pillow, stare at the ceiling and say, dadgummit, I'm an idiot. I just can't get over this. I can't stand myself, right? Self-loathing comes in. And Jesus walks into your room and he holds your hand. He says, man, you were fighting hard, right? And I love that you were fighting, but you lost. But I love that you were fighting. I love that when you were tempted, you were trying. Now, you didn't make it. But here's what I want you to know. I did. And you have my record. And I'm not going to shame you for that. I want you, right? You are on the team. It doesn't matter. That's who he is. And if that's who he is, then he says this. You can approach God's, you must approach God's throne of grace with confidence. How many times, if you've sinned, do you walk into church and start thinking about your walk with God and you just feel shame? That's not confidence. He wants you to come in with confidence. He has already gone before you, right? He's gone before you, told the Father, hey, everything's been paid for. I've defeated all sin. They are in. And so many of us are struggling with depression. We're struggling with self-doubt. And the thing is that Jesus understands you. He knows what it's like to be in your struggle, whatever it is right now. He has struggled with it. He has been tempted in every single way, except for what? He had victory. That is the true and living God. Now, when you think about this, when you think of temptation and when you think of struggle, I know a lot of people who, they're tempted and they just give in, right? They don't even really struggle at all. They don't even really fight. And I love what C.S. Lewis says about this. He says, there's a silly idea. A silly idea is current that good people do not know what temptation means. This is an obvious lie. Only those who try to resist temptation know how strong it is. A man who gives in to temptation after 5 minutes simply doesn't know what it had been like an hour later. That is why bad people, in one sense, know very little about badness. They have lived a sheltered life by always, what? By always giving in. I don't know if you've ever watched one of these old, like, strongman competitions. I know, I'm a little weird, but it was a rerun of these, like, Icelandic monster men, like Magnus von Magnussen or whatever. And, you know, the one I was watching this week, it looked like a huge cowbell, right, with a big handle. And I weighed a couple hundred pounds. And all they had to do is they had to stand against the wall, and they just had to hold it as long as they could, right? And there was this one guy that got up, and they're all huge. But this one guy got up, and it got a little tough, and he just dropped it. And I'm like, man, that guy didn't even, it's like, he didn't even hang on. He didn't even, have a grip. And then this other guy gets up there, and he's going for like 40 seconds, and his whole body's shaking. He's just trying to keep this thing up, to win the competition. And, you know, it's, and ultimately he dropped it. But when you do that, when you hold fast, when you fight, God loves it. He is not just about you having victory. He's about creating a fight and a grip as you go through these struggles. He wants to see your grip, you know, get stronger and stronger and stronger. And though he never, you know, he never lost his grip, even though we do, he says, I am doing something in you. Don't let go. Because look at the other verb in that. He says what? He says, let us approach God's throne of grace with confidence. We have to go to him. We have to hold fast, but we also have to draw near. And I know for some of us, you know, that's the last thing that you want to do. But we have to approach God. Do you know this? That in every temptation that you're going to face this week, here's what Paul says to the Corinthians, who stopped trying. A lot of the Corinthians just said, you know what? The world's too tough. Are you kidding me? I've lived a certain way 40 years of my life, and you want me to be pure in all these ways and stop doing this? And so many of them stopped because they felt hopeless and they felt helpless. And here's what the promise Paul gives them and gives you. No temptation has overtaken you that is not common to man. God is faithful, and he will not let you be tempted beyond your ability. But with the temptation, he will always provide the way of escape that you may be able to endure it. Do you know there's always a way out of the temptation that you're struggling with? We know you're not always going to have victory, but there's always the possibility, if you have Jesus, if you have the Spirit, for you to have victory. Do you know that? That when you are thinking about making that decision, there is a way for you to choose Jesus in that moment. He promises that. Think about in the moments of temptation. You've got Joseph and Potiphar's wife, and you have David and Bathsheba. Potiphar's wife is coming on to Joseph, and he goes, you know what I'm going to do? Because sometimes you have to fight, but in this situation, obviously God said, flee. You need to run, buddy. Get out of that house. That's exactly what he did. And he had victory over sexual sin. And at the very time, all David needed to do was what? Not look at her. You can't stare at her. You can't fixate on that. In that moment, what do we know? David had a way out. Now, God will still use, right? He'll still use our failings, but you need to know, it's very hopeful for me to know, that anytime I'm tempted, there's always a way out. Do you believe that? He will always provide a way of an escape out for you. Because when we approach him and we believe it and we take those steps of faith, what does it say that we get? Approaching God allows us to receive. But let's go to the next slide, because this is the last. We receive mercy and grace. You receive God, right? God helping you out of the trappings of sin, his mercy, and you receive the power of grace. When you approach him, you know this. When you are prayed up, when you've spent time with God, you know what? Intimacy with God helps purity in your life. When you are approaching God, why is it that when we, you know, particularly these past couple of months, we've heard our kids get away and spend time with God, and they're approaching the throne of grace, and they've probably approaching it with more confidence than they've ever approached it with. To see a 12-year-old boy talk about being with God, spending alone time with God, what do you think he receives there? Well, he receives the presence of God, but he also receives the gift of mercy and grace, and this allows us to win. So what are you giving up when you don't approach the throne of grace? And that's what Morgan was saying last week. You know, there's this idea that our design is to come together and rest on the Sabbath. What if you violate your design? What if you don't use your car the way it was designed? It stops working. when we enter into Sabbath rest, when we don't give up meeting together, as it says, as some are in the habit of doing, we then, when we do that, when we enter into our design, I believe you'll have more victory. That doesn't mean you'll have total victory, but will you have more? Will you receive more mercy and grace? Yes. And sometimes we miss out on that. As Presbyterians, we want to hold fast to our doctrine, right? And so when it says the Spirit of God comes upon us, and that in that moment of temptation, we're really good at saying, well, God forgives you. Of course he does. But what in that moment, if you had the ability to not sin against your family and instead bring life to them? Think about what that does. Think about what that does to your ministry, ministry effectiveness. And so when you're feeling tempted, do you know that you have someone who sympathizes with the struggle, who's already defeated your struggle, and has given you a way out? So you can mess up, and he's not going to be mad at you. But here's what he wants. He wants you to engage. He wants you to say, you know what? I will walk through the valley of the shadow of death, and I'm not going to fear any evil. His rod and his staff, they're going to comfort me. And when we do that, you know what we don't do? We don't give up. Because some of you, I wonder, it's going to be easy for you just to go on cruise control and say, you know, I don't want to enter into the baptism of the Spirit, because you know what? I don't want to enter into the desert. But then you're on the sidelines, right? And you're watching it happen. And he's saying, enter in. Peter, horrible sinner, unbelievable ambassador of Christ. When he got close to Jesus, man, did he mess up. But you know what? He did not give up, because here's what he knew. His Jesus loved him no matter what. When you experience that, so I want to end. I don't normally do this, and this is kind of a long poem. But as I read this and I thought about many of us in this race and what we want to do, I want to read it to you. And it's a little bit longer, but I think as if you think about the face of God the Father and you think about this Son, I want you to think about Jesus as our priest and God the Father as the one who gives us his Spirit. It reads this: quit, give up, you're beaten. They shout at me and plead. There's just too much against you now. This time you can't succeed. And as I start to hang my head in front of failure's face, my downward fall is broken by the memory of a race. And hope refills my weakened will as I recall that sacred scene. For just the thought of that short race rejuvenates my being. A children's race, young boys, young men, now I remember well. Excitement, sure, but also fear. It wasn't hard to tell. They all lined up so full of hope, each thought to win the race. Or tie for first, and if not that, at least take second place. And fathers watched from off the side, each cheering for his son. And each boy hoped to show his dad that he would be the one. The whistle blew and off they sped, as if they were on fire. To win, to be the hero there, was each boy's deep desire. And one boy in particular, whose dad was in the crowd, was running near the lead and thought, my dad will be so proud. But as he speeded down the field, across the shallow dip, the little boy, who thought to win, lost his step and slipped. Trying hard to catch himself, his arm flew out to brace. And the laughter of the crowd, he fell flat on his face. So down he fell, and with him hope. He couldn't win it now. Embarrassed, sad, he only wished to disappear somehow. But as he fell, his dad stood up and showed his loving face, which to the boy so clearly said, get up and win the race. He quickly rose, no damage done, behind a bit, that's all, and ran with all his mind and might to make up for the fall. So anxious to restore himself, to catch up and to win, his mind went faster than his legs. He slipped and fell again. He wished he had quit before with only one disgrace. I'm hopeless as a runner now. I should give up the race. But in the laughing crowd, he searched and found his father's face. That steady look that said again, get up and win the race. So he jumped up to try again, 10 yards behind the last. If I'm to gain those yards, he thought, I've got to run real fast. Exerting everything he had, he regained 8 or 10. But trying so hard to catch the lead, he slipped and fell again. defeat. He lay there silently, a tear dropped from his eye. There's no sense running more. Three strikes, I'm out, why try? The will to rise had disappeared, all hope had fled away. So far behind, so error-prone, a loser all the way. I've lost, so what's the use, he thought. I'll live with my disgrace. But then he thought about his dad, who soon he'd have to face. Get up, an echo sounded low. Get up and take your place. You weren't meant for failure here. Get up and win the race. With borrowed will, get up, it said. You haven't lost at all. For winning is no more than this, to rise each time you fall. So up he rose to win once more, and with a new commit, he resolved that win, that win or lose, at least he wouldn't quit. So far behind the others now, the most he'd ever been, still, he gave it all he had and ran as though to win. Three times he's fallen, stumbling. Three times he rose again, too far behind to hope to win. He still ran to the end. They cheered the winning runner as he crossed the line first place. Head high and proud and happy, no falling, no disgrace. But when the fallen youngster crossed the line last place, the crowd gave him the greater cheer for finishing the race. And even though he came in last with head bound low, unproud, you would have thought he won the race to listen to the crowd. And to his dad, he sadly said, I didn't do so well. What? To me you won, his father said, because you rose each time you fell. And when things seem dark and hard and difficult to face, the memory of that little boy helps me in my race. For all of life is like that race with ups and downs and all you have to do to win is rise each time you fall. Quit, give up, you're beaten, they still shout in my face. But then I hear another voice that says, get up and win the race. Amen? That's the voice of our Father, who's watching you run this race, and you're going to be tempted, and he says, just get up and keep running. I love you. I empathize with you. Are you going to run? Are you going to get up? Let's ask God for help.